for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When Mathieu Ricard was in his 20s, he left a promising career in cellular genetics to become a Buddhist monk. Ricard lived in relative obscurity until he started writing books on happiness and the meaning of life, which have all become bestsellers. His talks have been viewed by more than 7 million people online. In a new book, Ricard argues that altruism and compassion are keys to solving major problems like inequality and climate change. His book is titled Altruism, The Power of Compassion to Change Yourself and the World. Mathieu Ricard joins me from the NPR Bureau in New York City. You are, as always, invited to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send me an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. How wonderful to see you, sir.
I'm so happy to be in dialogue with you, Diane.
Thank you. As one of the millions who have watched your TED Talk, and I know you've also spoken at Davos, I wonder, truly, with humility, what is the best way, the appropriate way, to address a Buddhist monk?
It depends in which country. I think, you know, I love simplicity. When people ask me what is my title in the monastery, I say I'm the sweeper.
You're the sweeper.
Because, you know, it's so much better to be in the most humble position because you cannot fall down. So better take it from the beginning. So Mathieu will be fine in all times, in all places.
Thank you. All right. And to begin with, tell us how you are defining altruism.
So it is fundamentally a mental state, an intention, and a motivation. At some point in your mind, of course not all the time, that would be great, you have a thought that is the main goal and ultimate goal is to benefit someone or to remedy to that person's suffering. So, of course, as much as possible, as much as circumstances allow it, it should be followed by action. But imagine that somehow this cannot be possible. It is still altruistic because your intention was clearly and genuinely to help others. Now, if you only look at the behavior, you cannot for sure determine if the motivation was altruistic. You could do something extremely beneficial to the person, somehow to please that person, to gain their favors, and possibly to cheat that person. So initially, the behavior benefits the person, so it may be seen as an altruistic action, but the motivation sort of makes it to be selfish. So it has to be at the motivation level. And it's not that we are always altruists for everyone, but we do have genuine moments of unconditional altruism.
And it seems to me that at least when I have thought about altruism, it would be a one-to-one person action. But what you're talking about is global in its reach.
Yes, so you see, the global idea to extend altruism is more to generate a sense of readiness, of benevolence. It's not sort of seeing, you know, infinity of beings, and it sort of become a very diluted sort of kind of almost, you know, disincarnated altruism. It is a state of general benevolence that a priori you have a benevolent attitude to whoever may come in the field of your attentions. So basically, every being that can make the difference between happiness and suffering and that comes to the field of your attention sort of get exposed to that benevolence, just as if the sun shines on everyone. When someone comes in the sunlight, he gets the warmth and the light. So it's not you know, becoming something abstract, sort of diluted, not connected to human beings. Because, of course, if you have that in your way of being, and then when you meet one-to-one with one person, that's what will come at the surface.
So what made you tell us a bit about your background and how you've reached this point of sweeper in life?
Well, you know, I was fortunate to, you know, grow up in a wonderful sort of surrounding in France. My father was a well-known philosopher. My mother is a 92 years old now, painter. And the uncle, who was an explorer, went around the world on a sailboat, you know, after the Second World War. So I would certainly meet at our home many colorful people, people who were excelling in mathematics, in art. I had the immense fortune, as I was myself, very passionate about classical music, to meet Igor Stravinsky when I was 16. You know, what a dream. But at the same time, there was something sort of, I was in a lab with two Nobel Prize of Medicine, but there was something that was puzzling me. I didn't know how to articulate that. But later on, when I thought about it, you know, there was all this array of people having different genius and different skills in different domains, but it's hard to relate with human qualities. You take 100 gardeners, 100 philosophers, and you have the same distribution of wonderful people and very difficult people. So there was something like that. But what can I take as a model in life to become a good human being? So when I was 20, I saw some documentaries on all the great Tibetan Buddhist masters who had fled Tibet because of the communist invasion of their country. And suddenly I saw that and thought, whoa, here are 20 Socrates, 20 Saint Francis of Assisi, alive, now I'm going. So I went, I met them, and I was, of course, extremely inspired by the sort of adequation between what they were teaching and what they were. The messenger was the message. So I went back and forth a number of times when I was finishing my PhD. And then when time came to do a postdoc, my boss wanted me to go to here to the United States. I said, look, I'm going to do my postdoc in the Himalayas. Huh? And I've been doing so for 50 years. Of course, not on cellular genetics, but on studying with those masters. So for 25 years, I was really more or less cut from everything. And then it's only in 1997, when this book was done with my father, Jean-François Revel, that, boom, I was again exposed, you know, to the limelight of the everything else in Europe.
Tell me how your parents felt when you said, I'm going to the Himalayas to do my postdoc.
Yes. No, my mother was not surprised because she had the same inclination that I had. And she actually came a few months after me. She became a Buddhist nun. She did 3 years retreat. So we had the same teachers. Sometimes we were together. Sometimes she was in France. I was there. So that was a great harmony until now. My father, you know, as he said later, every philosopher dreams of having a son who is a scientist. So he was very surprised, disappointed. For him, it was, although, you know, I finished everything I had to do. I finished my PhD. I published a scientific paper. So there was a chapter that was done. But he had the generosity of not making a huge drama. No, I don't like those dramas. We never were in bad terms ever. But he was a mute catastrophe. You know, he felt very bad. And if a good friend of his told me later that he came to see him and he cried.
Ah.
But you know, when we we discussed after the book and the media asked him what you felt at that time. He said, you know, Matthew was 26, someone who can decide what he wants to do with his life. And then when I saw that he was flourishing in life and so happy there, he came to see me a few times. You know, so many parents are in despair because their children don't do well, sort of fall in depression or don't know where to go in life. So even if it's not the idea that you had for a career, to see someone who is enjoying what he does, well, I think for a parent it's a good thing.
So what about your colleagues in the mathematical world? What did they think?
So, you know, some were surprised. My immediate boss, François Jacob, one of the Nobel laureates, he said, you know, seeing that you are doing quite well, because I was lucky to find a few things when I was doing my PhD, so that sort of speeded up my PhD because I found a few interesting things. I was studying the cell division of bacteria. And then he said, well, I became surprised that you decided to go to the Himalayas. But he was a very open-minded and generous person. And then when I came back to France on a more regular basis 25 years later, I went several times to see him. And he was very happy. We were friends again. I sent him my books. And so I think it was lucky that everything was quite harmonious, even though in the beginning they sort of wondered what I was going to do there.
Mathieu Ricard, his brand new book is titled Altruism, The Power of Compassion to Change Yourself and the World. Short break here. We'll be right back. And if you've just joined us, Mathieu Ricard is with me. He joins me from the NPR Bureau in New York City. His new book is titled Altruism, The Power of Compassion to Change Yourself and the World. I mentioned at the start of the program that I had watched his TED Talk. You too can see that TED Talk. We have a link to it at our website, drshow.org. Also a link to the talk he made in Davos. And if you'd like to join us now, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Mathieu, you said after you had completed your studies, you did go to the Himalayas. You began learning from Buddhist monks. The question becomes how much of altruism is something we have innately, but somehow because of the competition that has become such a strong motivator in this world, how much of altruism is tamped down because of that?
Well, you see, any of the skills and capacity and potential that we have will be expressed. Of course, there are different dispositions among people. It's true for everything, you know, physical capacities, name it. Yes. So whatever your baseline, wherever you start from, there's a kind of significant margin of enhancing that particular skills if you attend to it, if you pay attention to it, and somehow if you train in the sense, not necessarily like you go on a treadmill, although the meditation is, or mind training is a form of regular exercise of certain qualities, but simply by over and again mentally being exposed to a certain way of thinking. So it's quite sure that if, you know, the idea of competition occupies your mind most of the time, that's going to change what you are. It's going to change your brain through neuroplasticity. It might even change the expression of some genes through epigenetics. So we're actually shaped by thought after thought, emotion after emotion, mood after moods will shape our traits and our predisposition. But nothing came, sort of any of our skills came without training. We were not born learning how to read and write. So now the potential for altruism, for solidarity, and even cooperation is actually fortunately innate in human beings. And that is expected because we are social animals. So it's so much better as a social animal to cooperate than somehow kick each other's leg all day long. So if you look at the studies which have been done over the last 15, 20 years with very young children, and you see they are sort of unconditional cooperators. That's the first trait that appears. You know, in the lab, if someone drops a pen, the kids jump. 99% of the children will go to pick up the pen. If the experimenter throws it on the floor, they know it's intentional, it doesn't need help, they don't go. So that's a common trait among young children. There's another study who show that they naturally prefer people who behave well to another than those who are a little bit nasty. They do that with puppets or with little balls with big eyes. One tries to climb a slope. Another nice ball comes from behind and help it. But there's a green ball coming from the top that pushes down. You hand over those two balls to the 2 years old, 95% pick up the nice helping ball. They could even show that by following the gaze of 3-month-old babies, that they go, their eyes go 90% to the nice helping ball. So that tendency is much into us. That's why we must somehow provide the condition in society to allow this natural propensity to cooperate, not to be stifled by a culture of, you know, reckless competition. And if you see the situation of the world today, you could imagine at a certain point in our history, competition was quite good. But when we are soon maybe 9 billion people with so many challenges, no, it's obvious in my mind that the trait that will be most favorable to be able to deal with those challenges will be to cooperate together, to have a sense of solidarity, to have consideration for each other.
We have an email from David in New York who says, this is a very nice philosophy, but what can be done about genetics? He goes on to say, 60% of men have the warrior gene, which, when activated, makes these men wake up angry and go to sleep angry. Some of us still have cave clan genetics. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, the genetic issue has been vastly exaggerated. All my geneticist friend, and I was studying genetics, I mean, they did a PhD in genetics, all say that this idea of 60%, 50% is basically exaggerated. It's probably more in the range of 20%. Plus, one of the most vibrant fields of genetics last 20 years is what we call epigenetics. If your genes are not expressed, or if a gene that's supposed to be dormant is not being expressed, you change the blueprint. And it has been shown, for instance, that 8 hours of meditation on caring mindfulness does change the expression of genes. It has been shown that children which have been abused, there is a change in their epigenetic pattern. Whatever you get from the environment can change the expression of our genes. So yes, we are born with certain predisposition. Some people may have more or less an altruistic or angry tendency, but that could be changed in two ways. If you train in compassion, benevolence, neuroplasticity shows very clearly that you don't have to wait for 20 years. Within a few weeks, your brain will change functionally and structurally. It will be different.
And yet, you yourself say in your book, Altruism, that selfishness is at the heart of most of the world's problems. Talk about selfishness.
I certainly paid attention to the fact that selfishness is present, but basically the whole theme of the book is to refute the theory of universal selfishness, because many people have said, philosophers, early psychologists, some classical economics, that we are, whatever we do, even it looks altruistic, if you dig deep within, you will find a selfish motivation. So this is really armchair science. There's never been a single sociological, psychological study ever supporting this hypothesis of universal selfishness. Rather, someone like psychologist Daniel Batson and many others who spent 20 years of their career to devise very ingenious sort of situations to put people so that no matter what, even you give easy escape and different sort of schemes, there's a significant number of people who will act in altruistic way. So far, there's no single proof for the notion of universal selfishness. So that's a good sign. Of course, selfishness does exist. It might take extreme forms, which I call institutionalized selfishness. When you know you are doing harm, say like tobacco companies that kill 6 million people every year in the world, 100 million in the 20th century, as much as two world wars, and we still want to continue their trade, knowing that, you know, they get a license to kill. So knowing that, to continue such activity, which is, of course, present in many quarters of our world, is a form of selfishness.
And what about economically? What about the economics in this country, where apparently 1% of the population holds the greatest wealth?
So there are two big issues, as you mentioned at the beginning, that for the present in the growing inequalities in all the 36 OECD, the 36 developed countries in the world that have been increasing for the last 30 years, is a major issue, because inequality are detrimental to security, to trust. There's a lower level of education, of health, you know, on average, lower life expectancy. Inequalities are basically deleterious to society. So this is a problem. And how can you solve that? You know, if you go with the classical economic system, like one of the founders of modern economy, Francis Edgeworth, said there's no place for altruism in economic system. So that's not going to work. If you're only about to maximize your personal interest and personal preference, why should you care for poverty in the midst of plenty? Why should you care for the quality of the air, of the ocean, of the environment? So you need what my friend Denis Snower, who is a respected economist, he founded the Global Economic Symposium, which is like a mini Davos. He says we need the voice of care along the voice of reason. Because, you know, in our times, maybe if we tell an economist, you know, you should be compassionate, they say, well, of course, as an individual, I can be, but that's not what economy is about. But who can say today, I don't care about inequalities, I don't care about the environment? That discourse doesn't go anymore. So to care, a caring economics means you step out of that simple, selfish maximization of personal interest to be concerned by others. And that's something that we all have the potential for.
And yet you've heard even public figures say, well, you know, I can't worry today about how 100 years from now somebody's water is going to be affected.
Well, you know, if you have a house and before you leave it to your children, your grandchildren, great-grandchildren, if you burn the house, that's not very kind. So, you know, we are now 7 billion people on Earth, and somehow we decide the fate of billions and billions of billions of people who don't exist, but they will exist. And they will say, you knew, and yet you did nothing. So they are not going to bless us. So what is the solution to that? You know, over the world, over the last 6-7 years when I was doing the research for the book, I met so many wonderful people in all fields of life. You know, environmentalists, social workers, politicians, economists, neuroscientists. And it seemed that there is a very hard time to talk together. When environmentalists tell, you know, this is going to happen in 60 years, economist says, yes, but that's not my job. You know, I have to see the balance sheet at the end of the year. So there's this kind of schizophrenic split between the short term, which is the economy, the midterm, the quality of life, how people can flourish in one generation, in their lifetime, and then the fate of future generation. So we need a concept, because those are not bad people. basically they have a potential for goodness. They are sometimes good family persons and so forth. So we, I think we'll be happy to work together for a better world. So we need a common concept. And I only see altruism as this unifying concept.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The question becomes, how do you create an altruistic society? In your Buddhist monastery, presumably everybody is thinking along the same lines because they do the kind of thoughtful meditation each and every day. You don't have that in such a pluralistic world.
Well, that's right, you know, but the book I wrote is a human being who happens to be a Buddhist monk who explored that subject. It is clear, of course, is one of your main goals is to cultivate in yourself this altruism. You have a better chance to act upon that. And in fact, now since 15 years, you know, we started a foundation called Karuna, which means compassion, which has now achieved 140 projects in Asia, in Nepal, Tibet, and India. And now we treat 120,000 patients every year. And we helped 70,000 people after the earthquake in Nepal. So we do put it in action. But how can you see more the global picture, of course? First of all, we should not fall in a kind of dark pessimism. You know, Anna Arendt spoke about the banality of evil, about Adolf Eichmann, how people get caught into this escalation of evil. But I think also we can speak of the banality of goodness. We see so many wonderful things. There are millions of NGOs, you know, come grassroots, from bottom up in society, devoting their time to helping others. If you look at day-to-day life, there are much more actions of being decent, being kind, being polite, being helpful to each other. If 100 people cooperate to go to help the elderly or the socially, you know, challenged people, nobody's going to report in the evening news. If one of those persons goes to rob a bank, then you share he will be in the evening news. So there's a kind of distortion of what it actually makes the fabric of our daily life, which is much more attuned to, you know, pro-social behavior than the opposite. Now, a 20-year-old person in North America and Europe has seen 40,000 violent deaths on TV or film. What does that have to do with reality? I have been in many, many challenging places. I was doing the Maoist insurgency in Nepal for so many years. I have seen dead people. I never seen someone being killed under my eyes, and certainly not 40,000. So it gives you, it paints a quite bleak picture of human nature that doesn't correspond to reality. So first of all, we become some kind of confidence that we have that potential. And then we need to change individually because society are made of individuals. So there's many ways to cultivate altruism. Then finally, we need to find the articulation point to go from individual change to societal change. And that's about the evolution of cultures. Sometimes an idea becomes the idea that it seems to be right, you know, ethically, morally. Even 10% of people show clearly this idea, then the sort of critical mass and tipping point in our culture. That's how culture changed, and that has been studied, and it's a wonderful process, and that's how we could and we should go to a more altruistic society.
Mathieu Ricard, and after a short break, we're going to open the phones, take your comments, questions, as we speak about how you can use the power of compassion to change yourself and the world. And before we open the phones, Mathieu Ricard, I'd like you to talk just a little bit about neuroplasticity and the neuroscience experiments that you've been involved with at Richard Davidson's lab in Madison, Wisconsin.
So the idea, you know, there is an institute called the Mind and Life Institute that has been founded 28 years ago to bring together top scientists with the Dalai Lama once a year. Sometimes they meet for 5 days or 2 days. So in 2000, I joined meetings on destructive emotions, and I met Richard Davidson, Paul Ekman, many other luminaries. And then the idea came up of seeing if long-term meditators, you know, would there be change in their brain when they engage in compassion meditation, in focused attention? Would there be structural change? Are their brain different? So I volunteered as an ex-scientist. I thought it was a very interesting collaboration. So now I must have spent 120 hours in MRI machines in different labs in in the U.S., in Europe. So what turned out is that for people who have done long-term meditators, I was the first guinea pig, but many others then of my colleagues, both monks, not monks, men, women, Easterners, Westerners. So it's not about Tibetan monks. It's people who did many years of meditation. It was clear, for instance, when they engaged in compassion meditation, there was activation in certain areas of the brain of a magnitude that Richard Davidson said were never reported earlier in neuroscience. And then you can see also structural change in the brain. Well, you might say, okay, so that's neuroplasticity. That's something that was discovered about 20 years ago. Earlier, they thought that the brain, adult brain, will not change. It's so complex that you will mess it up. It turns out that until we die, the brain can change a big way. You know, you can manufacture 30,000 new neurons every month if you train in anything.
And what you must do for us is to explain compassion meditation.
So basically, you know, it's nothing mysterious. Like, we all have moments of unconditional love for someone we love, a child, a close person, even an animal. And we don't have to force ourselves. You know, it flows from our heart. We only wish, may this person be well, be safe, be free from suffering. And if that person suffers, that altruistic love become compassion. That is the wish that the cause of suffering may be dispelled. But, you know, we think of that quite strongly for half a minute, say, then other things happen. Someone comes in the room, we do something, so it goes away. So if it's like if we were playing the piano 1 minute every 15 days and nothing else, so we'll never become a pianist player. So meditation or training is simply to generate that in our mind, thinking of someone for whom it is easy, you know, like a young child is a good example, and then cultivate that, nourish that. No, for more than 45 seconds, you maintain that for 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. If it declines in quality, you revive it. If you are distracted, you come back to it. So you monitor that so that this becomes a state that you keep on for 10, 15 minutes. If we do that, just as you learn how to juggle or to play the chess or to play the piano, it turns out that you become different. You can see that in your own experience. And neuroscience shows that you don't have to wait for 60,000 hours, but after a few weeks already, you can see changes clearly happening in the brain.
And what about changes in behavior?
That's right. So Richard Davidson recently did a study, 2 weeks of 20 minutes a day of compassion meditation, and he showed a significant increase of prosocial behavior in those subjects compared to a control group who just did something else.
All right, let's open the phones to John in Corinth, Vermont. You're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And you're Matthew, you're wonderful. I love just the notion that humanity is benevolent. We are benevolent, and it's wonderful you're trying to unify these fields. I think it's fantastic. I do, however, believe that for a person to be genuinely altruistic, they need to be genuinely good with themselves. And that philosophy sort of comes first, right? The individual notion that they're happy with themselves seems to come first before any notion of altruism can follow. So I think the notion that altruism coming first And then them being good with themselves, it's going to be a contrived sort of altruism instead of stemming from individual gain and then large gain.
Yes. So I think you are right. So, in the Western psychology, we have this concept of self-compassion. If people have what is unfortunately happens that people have self-hate, either they have a contempt upon themselves or they devalue themselves and they become either depressed or angry and they think there is no opportunity for them to be happy, it would be very hard, of course. It would be painful even to try to have compassion for others if they don't have compassion for themselves. Now, in the Buddhist terms, we say, what you say, how does that relate to the way we meditate? So the first thing before generating compassion to others is to at least identify that deep, deep within ourselves. No, if it was possible, we'd rather not suffer. No, nobody wakes up in the morning thinking, may I suffer the whole day and if possible my whole life. Of course, there are people who have been denied happiness due to abuse, due to being object of contempt by their people around them, and it's very hard for them. But somehow, deep within, if you could show them the possibility of happiness, why would they want to suffer forever? So once you recognize that, then you start valuing that aspiration. It's not selfish. No, it's not selfish to want to be happy, of course, and to flourish in life. Why should that be selfish? Your happiness is just as valuable as anyone's happiness. But then when you have clearly identified that, then the next step is to say, if others, even they are confused, even they don't know, they turn their back to happiness, they seem to be addicted to the cause of suffering, but deep within, they also would prefer not to suffer. So if I value that, then I become naturally concerned. So that's why, in that way, gradually you can extend that concern for others.
But now, here's an email from Berkeley in Pennsylvania who says, I've suffered major depression and anxiety since I was a child. A few years ago, I discovered the tenets of Buddhism. I found great comfort and inspiration. However, like many sufferers, I have a hard time being altruistic to myself. What advice do you have to help emotionally troubled people who want to help the world and themselves get better?
I think it is, as the former person said as well, it is important to recognize that fundamental aspiration to be free from suffering. If you don't recognize that clearly and start to push too hard on helping others while this being unresolved within yourself, somehow it's going to create a tension. I work in the humanitarian field for the last 15 years. We see sometimes people who have a lot of issues unsolved, who come to help, and somehow at some point it's too hard. They cannot do anymore. They have a sort of burnout. So it is very healthy to cultivate both at the same time, to discover that, yes, I would rather be happy. Let's find the means for that, and that leads you naturally to find the wish to help others.
And here's an email from Sam who says, when I try to meditate, I find my thoughts drifting, even when I try to focus on my breathing. Can you offer some tips on how one can control one's thoughts to maintain focus?
Well, usually when we start meditating, we say, it seems I have more thoughts than usual. It's not really you have more thoughts. You just become aware of the extent of the catastrophe. I mean that, in fact, thoughts keeps on revolving like a whirlpool from morning till evening. And we have to deal with our mind all day long. Our mind can be our best friend or our worst enemy. So it's not surprising, like any skills that we begin to cultivate, that in the beginning there's some element of contrived effort, tension, and we don't do things so well. Like if you learn how to ride a bicycle, you are tense, you are nervous, you don't do it well. with time, and that's why the whole point of meditation is training. With time, exercise. With time, things become natural. You are kind of in a flow of attention. So you do it well and more effortlessly. And that can only come with time. So the secret is to persevere. If you want to grow a plant in your apartment, you add a little water every day and the plant will grow. If you add a big bucket every month, the plant will die in between. So it's regularity, sort of enthusiasm by seeing gradually the result of it. And normally you should come to a state where the mind is a bit more calm, a little bit more clear, and a little bit more stable.
All right, to Steve in Rockville, Maryland, you're on the air.
Yes, I really appreciate this because I have a master's degree in sociology from University of Wisconsin-Madison, as it happens. And the subject of my thesis was symbolic altruism, I called it, meaning doing good by giving money to agencies and organizations that do good. Because I'm conscious that, for example, saving a drowning person could be just a matter of instinct, running into the water and helping the person. Whereas giving money, you have to stop and think, what's the best cause, what's the best agency? Your foundation sounds like a good place to give money. So I just wonder what you think of what I call symbolic altruism in that definition. And I can take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks.
So, you know, you certainly know the studies conducted by Elizabeth Dunn and her colleague in Canada and elsewhere. They studied people who give regularly, you know, even small amounts, or people who are big philanthropists. And they looked at in 27 countries. They control well for their social background, education, health, and so forth. And they found that people who are in the habit of giving are significantly happier. So she wrote a paper in Science, which is not a small scientific journal, saying money doesn't buy happiness unless given to others. So that's a good start. So it is true. I think because, you see, you know, some people have argued that if you help others, you feel the warm glow, it's somehow selfish because, oh, I did that and I feel so good. But I firmly believe if you just hear about that and you say, okay, I'm terribly unhappy, I don't care about others, I'm going to do an act of generosity and wait for the warm glow, that's not going to happen, because the warm glow is when you're genuinely generous and altruistic.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You wrote a book on happiness, but in it, you say that people often confuse happiness with pleasure. Explain the difference.
So first of all, there's nothing wrong with pleasure. You know, taking a hot shower after walking in the mountains, you know, it's a bliss in a way. But pleasure by nature depends on circumstances, on time, and it can easily change into neutral and something displeasant. You know, imagine you spend 24 hours in a hot shower. You know, it's not very pleasant. So, and also, if your only goal is to constantly repeat pleasurable sensation, this is more a recipe for exhaustion, not for happiness. So happiness, and also it's not necessarily shared by others. You know, you could feel intense pleasure at the cost of others suffering somehow. So happiness is more like a way of being. It comes with a cluster of qualities, including especially altruistic love and compassion, but also inner freedom, that you are not the slave of all your thoughts, inner sort of resilience, that you know you have the resources to deal with ups and downs of life. So a way of being, in fact, the more you experience it, instead of exhausting itself like pleasure, the more it deepens, the more it becomes stable. So that's a quite different approach. So they are not necessarily antagonistic. No, pleasure can contribute to happiness, but if pleasure is mixed with craving, for instance, that will be detrimental to happiness. You know, that can lead to addiction, for instance.
Finally, how do you see altruism affecting global climate change?
Well, you see, the question of climate change and, in a bigger way, the question of dealing with future generations, the fact that the way we go now, 30% of all species will have disappeared from Earth in 2050, the sixth major extinction since the apparition of life on Earth. So it's complex politically. We know how deciders have a hard time taking decision on that. Economically, it's complex. It's going to cost much more in 30 years, but it's not the same people who will pay the bill. And it is complex scientifically. I mean, there's a unanimity about that this is happening. This is human-made. But the details is going to be 2 degrees, 4 degrees, how it happens. This is complex. But in the end, as what I discovered when I was researching for the book, it comes to a question of altruism versus selfishness. You know, in 100 years, most of us won't be there. So if we don't care for future generation, there's no environment problem. There's no climate change problem. We don't care. So, you know, I love Groucho Marx. And he said, why should I care for future generation? What do they do for me? But, you know, as you said in the beginning of your show, some billionaires have been saying the same thing seriously about the rise of the ocean. Why should I change my behavior? Something happened in 100 years. So this is why altruism is at the heart. Having more consideration for future generation who will be there on Earth is at the heart of the issue of environmental change and climate change.
Do you believe it can truly happen in this Western civilization?
It will. I think there's the voice of reason and the voice of care can help us to achieve that. When you see, it's because of the growth of population, it's not the case. You know, if population grow to 9 billion, it will be mostly in Africa, in Asia. But if you look at those who are responsible for climate change, a North American emit 200 times more CO2 than a Tanzanian. So that's what we should remedy.
I wish I had 3 more hours to talk with you. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Matthieu Ricard. And his new book is titled Altruism, The Power of Compassion to Change Yourself and the World. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Europe-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts.